kind and gentle. He's going to Cambridge next year.
Felicity told me. She smiles. I smile. Our voices echo in the emptiness of the church. She picks up a carnation and uses secateurs to trim it to the desired length.
I used to think having children was our way of cheating death, she says reflectively. We wedge our foot in a closing door, you know, giving ourselves a glimmer of hope that we'll leave something behind. Some part of us will endure.
But surely you believe in heaven?
I do, yes. Even more so now. A part of me can't wait to get there. To see my Jodie.
Maggie raises her eyes to the ceiling, as though she suspects that Jodie may be listening to us.
Father Patrick says I'm allowed to be angry with God. He says anger is a natural human response to situations that are out of our control or beyond our ability to understand. But I still think it's wrong. Jodie deserved more. I deserved more. Father Patrick says that if ever I come to a place where I can't run, I should walk. And if I can't walk, I should crawl. And if I can't crawl, I should turn on my back, look up to heaven, and ask Christ for help.
Maggie snips another stem and arranges it in a vase. The police found £6,000 in Jodie's school locker. I leave the statement hanging. Maggie blinks at me, as though not comprehending. I try again. Have you any idea where she'd get money like that?
No. I mean, we don't have that sort of cash. We live month to month.
Could she have been holding the money for someone else?
Who?
Felix? Maggie makes a pfumph sound, as though I'm talking rubbish. Could she have been involved in something dangerous?
Like what?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Is everything all right, Maggie?
Asks a voice that echoes from all around me. A priest appears from a vestry. In his early 40s, with a shock of dark hair that is swept back in a wave, he's dressed in black trousers and a white open-necked shirt with small gold crucifixes pinned to each collar. You must be Father Patrick, I say, introducing myself. He has a warm, firm handshake and an uncertain frown.
Have we met before?
No. I was talking to Tasmin Whittaker. She remembered you were at the fireworks. You did Jodie a service by retrieving her tote bag. Maggie looks confused. Jodie had a problem with some boys, I explain. Father Patrick saw them off. The sudden revelation appears to embarrass him. How long have you been at the parish? I ask.
8 years.
You must have known Jodie quite well.
I try to know all of my parishioners.
It's a nothing answer.
They found money in Jodie's locker, says Maggie. £6,000.
Where did it come from?
Asks the priest. She shakes her head. I have to ask you about something else the police found in Jodie's locker. Perhaps we should talk alone? Outside? Maggie shakes her head.
I want Father Patrick to be here.
Jodie had a box of condoms in her locker. Maggie's mouth drops open, and her hand covers it instinctively, as though a word might suddenly fly out.
Ah, Jodie was a good girl,
she says defensively. Yes, of course, but there is evidence that she had sex with someone on the night she died.
She was raped.
Rapists don't normally use condoms. Maggie's voice grows strident, and tears prickle in her eyes.
Why are you telling me this? You have no right.
I'm trying to understand.
My little girl was raped and murdered, and now you're doing it all over again.
I promise you that's not my intention.
I think you should leave, says Father Patrick,
stepping into my space, making himself large. The odour of him touches my face, a mixture of shampoo, aftershave, and mouthwash. Foamy bits of spit are clinging to his lips. He puts his arm around Maggie's shoulders. She leans against him, pressing her face to his chest. The priest isn't finished with me.
I have spent the past week telling Maggie she is not to blame for what happened to Jody. That sometimes terrible things happen to good people. She thinks she's a bad mother. She thinks she could have saved her daughter. Her only respite has been to come here and talk to me. And to God.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to...
I want you to leave.
My shoes echo on the flagstones as I follow the centre aisle to the main entrance. As I pull open the heavy door, I turn back and see Father Patrick and Maggie sitting together. He holds her face in his hands and uses a handkerchief to wipe the tears from her cheeks. Chapter 34 Angel Face.
Did you go out today?
Cyrus asks. I nod, and watch him unpacking the Chinese takeaway, setting out the cardboard cartons and plastic trays.
Where did you go?
To the shops.
What did you buy?
Nothing. I'm wrestling with the chopsticks, unable to make my fingers wrap around them. A spring roll drops in the dipping sauce, making a mess.
Would you like a fork?
He asks. No, I snap, hating that I can't do something when he makes it look so easy.
Did you catch the number 22 bus?
He asks. Something like that? Instantly, I realise my mistake. There won't be a number 22 bus. He's caught me lying again, which means follow-up questions or accusations. Instead, he acts like nothing is wrong.
You should try the dumplings.
I sniff at the container. What's in them?
They're vegetarian.
How do you know it's not dog? They eat dogs in China. And pandas.
I don't think they eat pandas.
I spear a dumpling with a chopstick and chew one corner before emptying the rest of the carton into my bowl. Cyrus has poured himself a glass of wine. Can I have one?
You're not 18.
Are we really still arguing about that?
I have it on the authority of a High Court judge.
I take the last spring roll. Cyrus pours me half a glass of wine. I sip it, tentatively, not really liking the taste, but I don't want him to know that. What did you do today? I ask, not really interested.
I interviewed some people.
About the Jody Sheehan murder?
How did you know that?
You shouldn't leave your shit lying around the house.
What shit?
I shrug. Cyrus suddenly realises what he left in the library. The police interviews with Craig Farley.
Did you find the DVDs?
He asks. I admit to nothing. My silence says enough.
Christ, Evie! That's highly confidential material. It's the basis of court proceedings, evidence in a criminal trial.
Who am I going to tell?
That's not the point.
You didn't tell me the library was off limits.
It should have been obvious.
Not to me, I say. I need the rules written down and posted on the wall. Staff only, lights out, meal times, chores, lessons. Cyrus mutters something about putting a lock on the door, but I ignore him, spearing another dumpling with a single chopstick. We eat in silence for a while. So, did he do it? I ask.
What do you think?
I consider this for a moment. By the end, I think he would have confessed to bombing Pearl Harbor.
Okay, but was he telling the truth?
I don't know. Cyrus looks perplexed and starts again.
I thought maybe because of your ability, you might have been able to tell. I don't know how it works, this thing you do, whether it comes and goes, or if it's triggered by something.
I hesitate, not sure of what I want to say, or if I want to say anything at all. I can't explain what I see. It is something in the face, a false note, a flicker, an invisible light. I have to be up close, I whisper.
Pardon?
For me to tell if someone is lying, I have to be close to them, in the same room, looking at their face. I can't do it otherwise.
So, not from a DVD?
Not unless it's up close. Not accurately. I get a sense, that's all.
What was your sense about Farley?
He knows what he did was wrong, but I'm not sure if what he did is what you think he did. Cyrus has stopped eating and is leaning forward. Why is he looking at me like that? He seems to recognize my anxiety and pulls back, dropping the subject. I clear the table and start washing the dishes, remembering to rinse the glasses in clean water to stop them streaking. Cyrus picks up a tea towel.
I know you hate questions, but can I ask you one?
I don't respond.
How long have you had this...
I don't remember.
Was it before you became Evie Cormack?
I nod.
I know why it frightens you,
he says.
It would frighten me.
I'd have thought you'd like to know if someone was lying. It would make your job easier.
I wouldn't have a job at all.
Chapter 35.
Early morning. Lenny Parvel sends me a pager message. She wants to talk. I go to the library and open my laptop, waiting for her Skype call. Her image appears, but only the top of her head. She curses and tilts the screen down, but it goes too far. I can see chin and the collar of her dressing gown. She adjusts it again, centering herself. Her husband Nick is in the background, making a cup of coffee. He's wearing a t-shirt and boxers, showing off his hairy thighs. Nick is the hairiest man I've ever met, which is why Lenny calls him Bear.
Hi, Cyrus, he says, waving at the screen. Hi, Nick.
Will you put some clothes on?
Says Lenny, covering the camera with her hand. I can hear them arguing, although not seriously. Nick sells medical equipment to doctors and clinics, but his hours are flexible. His two boys are at university, or have graduated by now. They're good lads. A credit. Lenny removes her hand from the camera.
I had a call from Ness last night. The toxicology results are in. Jodie Sheehan had no drugs or alcohol in her system.
I sense there's something more.
Ness noticed that Jodie's hormone levels were high and ran a test. She was pregnant, 11 weeks. Ness might be able to get DNA from the fetal material, but the lab work has to be done in America and could take a week or longer. Any fetal DNA will have half the father's genes, which may be enough to identify someone.
Would Jodie have known she was pregnant? I ask.
Most girls are pretty good at keeping track, particularly in the age of smartphones.
I pause, processing the information. It could have no bearing on Jodie's murder. Then again, the degraded semen found on her thigh has added significance because it didn't belong to Farley. It's now more likely that Jodie had consensual sex earlier in the evening with a boyfriend or a hookup. 5 hours are still missing from her timeline. I want to ask Lenny what she's thinking, but there's too much evidence against Farley for her to change her mind, and there's now even less likelihood of an accomplice. This isn't about police ignoring new evidence. They are shoring up their case, ensuring the inconsistencies won't jeopardize the prosecution. Lenny is thorough and diligent. More importantly, she's honest. She doesn't plant evidence or frame suspects, but neither does she chase rabbits down rabbit holes, wasting time and resources. Knocking pipes signal that Evie is in the shower. She comes downstairs with her hair in a towel and her face set in a scowl.
There's no hot water?
Sorry, the pilot light went out. It's a storage system, so it might take a while for the boiler to heat up. She utters a curse under her breath and notices that I'm dressed.
Where are you going?
I have some people to see.
Can I come?
No.
I won't get in the way. I'll wait in the car, or downstairs, or wherever.
Evie looks at me hopefully. She doesn't want to spend another day on her own. Loneliness is not something I associate with Evie because she lives so completely in her head and makes no attempt to befriend people or socialise. Even so, I don't want her spending another day on her own. She should be outside, reintroducing herself to the world, not spending her time in a creepy old house.
Can you be ready in 15 minutes? I ask.
I can be ready in 5.
Evie comes downstairs dressed in jeans, cowboy boots, a long-sleeve top, and a denim shirt that she's wearing like a jacket. I have a shirt like that, I think, although I don't wear it often. I have to sweep fallen leaves off the windscreen of my red Fiat, which has faded to a mottled pink. Pigeons have crapped all over the bonnet, and someone has stuck a flyer beneath the wiper blades, advertising a clearance sale at a carpet showroom. Twice I've had towing notices from the local council, because neighbours mistook my car for an abandoned vehicle.
Nice, says Evie, being facetious.
The engine doesn't start first time. I encourage it under my breath. It splutters and coughs like a consumptive smoker. Before idling so roughly, we sway from side to side. I give it a moment to warm up.
Can you teach me to drive?
Asks Evie.
No.
Why not?
The bus stop is 2 minutes from the house.
It will make me more independent.
You don't have a car.
I could borrow this one.
That's not going to happen. She folds her arms and looks out the window as we head along Derby Road past Woolerton Park. It's early on a Sunday morning, and the traffic is light.
How did Jodie Sheehan die?
Asks Evie. I can't talk about the case.
Is it a state secret?
No.
Well then.
I don't respond.
I've watched the interviews, she says. I know she was hit from behind.
You have to stop going through my stuff.
Evie doesn't reply. Instead, she props her cowboy boots on the dashboard, above the glove compartment.
We're heading along Abbey Street, past the Priory Church, and onto Castle Boulevard, passing south of the city centre.
Does the CD player work?
No.
What about the radio?
I have to hit the right pothole. She sighs in disgust.
The post-mortem wasn't definitive, I say, answering her first question. The pathologist couldn't decide if she drowned or died of exposure.
Farley said he didn't rape her,
says Evie.
But even if he whacked off into her hair, it was a pretty sick act. A guy like that deserves to be locked up, you know. But I guess that doesn't prove he killed her.
An innocent man would have tried to help her.
Sometimes we don't have a choice.
The statement rattles something inside me, and I picture Terry Bolan being strapped to a chair, having acid poured into his ears, while Evie listened to his screams. I find a metered parking spot in the entertainment quarter of Nottingham and tell Evie to wait in the car.
It's cold. Can't I come with you?
Okay, but stay out of trouble. She joins me on the pavement, pulling up her collar and pocketing her hands. As we reach the corner, two young backpackers cross our path, a girl and a boy in their early 20s, who are talking excitedly in a different language. The girl laughs and calls the boy a name. Evie stops and turns. For a moment I think she's going to respond, but instead she watches the couple walk away.
What made you turn round? I ask.
Nothing.
Was it something she said?
No.
She sounded Russian or Polish. Did you understand her?
No.
What then?
She looked familiar,
says Evie. And I don't know whether to believe her.
That's the trouble with Evie. I risk reading clues into everything she does. Actions, inactions, silences, shrugs.
We're crossing Bolero Square to the National Ice Centre. A twin stadium building made of metal and glass. Pushing through the revolving doors, we step into a cavernous foyer dominated by a 40-foot-high poster montage celebrating British skating champions past and present. A woman at the information desk barely glances up from her screen. She hands Evie a form.
Fill out this for the academy trials. The changing rooms are through those doors. Don't put your skates on until you're on the ice.
She's not a skater, I explain. I'm here to see Brian Whittaker.
He's coaching.
I can wait. Evie and I follow signs to an amphitheatre the size of a concert hall with tiered seating on all sides, rising into darkness at the higher levels. The rink itself seems to glow from within, taking on a bluish tinge. A dozen skaters are warming up, gliding across the ice in graceful movements that look so effortless that a mere flick of their fingers sends them pirouetting or skating backwards. One of them accelerates, leaps and spins, landing on a single blade, arms outstretched and back arched. Most are dressed in tight black leggings and fitted tops. Training wear. I recognise Brian Whittaker. He's wearing an official-looking tracksuit and yelling instructions to a couple of the girls, who look to be 13 or 14. Other coaches are working with their own students. Whittaker claps his hands, signalling the girls to the side of the rink. He issues instructions. One of them shakes her head. He puts his hand on the back of her neck, pulling her face to his, touching foreheads, whispering, his eyes bright, a gold bracelet winking on his wrist. The girl nods and skates away, pulling up at the far end of the rink. After taking a few deep breaths, she sets off, swinging her arms as she builds up speed. She switches direction, skating backwards, and then switches again, leaping off one foot and spinning twice through the air, with her arms across her chest, before landing on her opposite foot and gliding in a graceful circle, unfurling her arms like wings. Whittaker claps. The girl beams. He nods to the next skater, who sets off across the ice, accelerating with less confidence. Stiff. Nervous. I can see her steeling herself, telling herself to jump, but at the last moment she pulls out of the attempt and circles back, hitting her thigh angrily. She collects herself and tries again, her face a mask of determination, ice flicking from her skates. But she doesn't have the speed when she leaps and spins. Her arms don't cross. Her legs tangle. Balance lost. She lands heavily and shoots across the ice, thudding into the hoardings. Whittaker goes to her. He picks her up. She's crying, hurt. He wipes her tears away and strokes her back like he's petting an animal. Do you want to try again? She nods. You don't have to.
I know.
She brushes ice from her knees and hips before skating back to her position. She tries again, looking even more determined. I don't want her to fall. Neither does Evie.
She should do one spin, she whispers. Two is too much.
The girl launches herself forward, caught in a truncated twirl before crashing and sliding across the ice. She gets up, ready to try again. Whittaker stops her.
That's enough for today, Lara. You'll get it tomorrow.
The girls glide towards the gate, chatting to each other. Whittaker goes to the side of the rink where he picks up a clipboard and makes a note. You stay here, I tell Evie, who seems fascinated by the display. Walking around the rink, I approach Brian Whittaker. He's a small man with delicate hands and the posture of a ballet dancer.
Dr. Haven, he says,
glancing up at me quickly and going back to the clipboard.
Bear with me.
He scribbles a further note.
Felicity said you'd drop by. I heard that some of Tasman's friends were there.
He steps through a gate and sits down to unlace his skates.
A tough session, I say.
Not really. If Lara can't land a double axel, she'll never land a triple. And without a triple, she'll never compete at the top level.
He moves to his other boot.
Figure skating may look graceful, but the falls are brutal on body and soul.
Was it like that for Jody?
He seems to relish the question.
Some skaters take 2 years to master a double axel. Jody took a month. It's a rare thing to find someone who can take the most difficult jump and within days make it look routine, like she could do it in her sleep.
Did you know Jody was pregnant?
Shock registers on his face. Perhaps Evie could tell if his reaction was genuine.
She didn't tell you?
No.
What would you have done?
Arranged an abortion.
Without telling her parents?
Whittaker pauses for a moment, glancing past me at the ice resurfacing machine that is moving back and forth across the rink. Maggie is very Catholic. She wouldn't have agreed.
What about Dougal?
He would have found the bastard who got her pregnant and broken him in half. Several ice dancers are circling the rink, waiting for the machine to finish. Whittaker watches them move in tandem, arm in arm, kicking and gliding.
8 years ago, one of your students made an allegation that you photographed her while she was in the shower.
There were no photographs. I didn't think anyone was in the changing room.
Why were you even there?
One of the girls phoned me. She thought she'd left her wallet in the changing room. I went to check. I knocked. I thought it was empty. I apologised to the girl in question.
Why did she say you took photographs?
That was her father. He thought he could get money out of me.
Where is the girl now?
The family moved to Leeds.
Another rink.
Just so. He pauses. Why are you asking me about her?
The pathologist thinks he can get a DNA profile from Jodie's unborn child. They'll be able to identify the father.
He shrugs ambivalently.
Aren't you interested?
Not particularly.
May I ask why?
It won't bring Jodie back. Something about his attitude annoys me. I can't tell if he's mourning the loss of his niece or the loss of a future champion, his ticket to reflected glory.
It must be a very close relationship, a coach and his student, working together, travelling to events, staying overnight.
His body tenses and his eyes are fixed on mine. What exactly are you suggesting?
Did you have separate rooms?
Whittaker's face goes through a transformation from amazement to anger as the red mist descends. His features become tighter and smaller, rushing to the centre of his face.
How dare you suggest? How dare you think?
It's a question that has to be asked.
It's a question that could destroy my career, he says angrily. Even the merest hint of something like that, and I'd never coach again. You have no right. You.
He can't finish.
The suggestion that I slept with my niece is obscene. You have a sick mind. A sick, sick mind.
Chapter 36. Angel Face. I've been watching them talking, but I'm too far away to hear what they're saying or decide if they're lying. Neither would be very good at poker. Too many tells. Cyrus is holding his emotions in check, but the coach is all over the place. When people swear on the Bible, promising to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, that's bullshit. Everybody lies. Lawyers, social workers, counsellors, doctors, foster carers, teenagers, children. It is what people do. They breathe, they eat, they drink, and they lie. I once did a survey at Langford Hall, keeping count of how many porkies I heard in a single day, and I came up with an average of 18 per person before lunch. These were only the obvious lies, not the small fictions that people tell to keep others happy. I love your new haircut. What a cute outfit. I didn't take your yogurt. Others were lies they told themselves. I'm not so fat. I'm not too old. I know what I'm doing. If I had more time, I would... The obvious lies are the easiest to pick. Others are better hidden, or so close to the truth that the dividing line is blurred. Some lies are selfish. Some inflate, or conflate, or mitigate, or simply omit. Some are told for good reason. People lie because they think it doesn't matter. They lie because telling the truth would mean giving up control, or the truth is inconvenient, or they don't want to disappoint. Or they desperately want it to be true. I've heard them all. I've told them all. Walking between the tiered seats, I follow the passage to the changing rooms. The two skaters I saw on the ice are putting on their street clothes. One of them is in a hurry to leave, angry with herself, slamming the door of her locker and limping out. The other is still unlacing her skates.
You were very good, I say. That's the first time I've ever seen anyone skate. Up close, I mean. When you see it on TV, you don't realise the speed or hear the sound of the skates on the ice. I sit down on the bench opposite her. I'm Evie, by the way. Alice. How long have you been skating, Alice?
Since I was 5.
Have I left it too late?
Anyone can skate. Most people just do it for fun.
Is it fun for you?
Today, yeah. Ask me tomorrow.
Alice pulls a heavy fleece over her head, lifting her hair out from the collar. Did you know Jodie Sheehan? I ask.
Sure, we train together.
With the same coach? Alice nods.
Mr. Whittaker.
Was Jodie his favourite? A cloud of uncertainty passes across her face.
He pushed her harder than the rest of us.
Why?
Because she was so good.
I wish I could have seen her skate, I say, running my finger over one of the blades. Can we play a game, Alice? She glances up nervously.
My mum is picking me up.
This won't take long. It's a bluffing game called Two Truths and a Lie. I tell you 3 things about me, and you pick which one is a lie.
Okay.
My real name isn't Evie. I'm a twin. And I can fit 4 boiled eggs in my mouth all at once.
That's a lie,
Alice laughs. You mean about the eggs? No, that's true. I could prove it to you if we had 4 boiled eggs. Now it's your turn. You tell me 3 things about Jodie, 2 truths and a lie.
Why Jodie?
It makes things harder. Alice begins thinking.
Okay, Jodie wanted to quit skating. She had a secret boyfriend, and she once screamed so loudly at a horror film that the girl next to her peed her pants.
That's hilarious, I say. Were you the girl? Alice nods, blushing.
How did you know?
I guessed. Why did Jodie want to quit skating? Alice looks over her shoulder and back again, whispering,
The headaches? She had 3 concussions in a row.
From falling? Alice nods.
She was trying to learn to triple axel.
Did Mr. Whittaker force her to keep trying?
Jodie didn't want to disappoint him.
What about her boyfriend?
That was supposed to be a lie,
says Alice.
I couldn't think of one.
It's hard to think of a lie when you need one, I tell her. Do you know his name?
No.
Why was he a secret?
I think he was older.
What makes you say that?
I mean, she wouldn't talk about him, so I thought...
Alice's phone is beeping. She glances at the screen.
I have to go.
She puts her skates away, forcing them into a crammed locker. Did Jodie have one of those? I ask. Alice nods and leads me around the corner where she points to a locker with blue and white police tape crisscrossed on the diagonals.
They searched that one, says Alice, but missed the other one.
What other one?
Jodie managed to get 2. Natasha quit during the summer, and she gave her key to Jodie, who never gave it back.
Alice takes me along the row and points to an unlabeled metal door. Her phone beeps again. She's late. Slipping her arms through the straps of a small backpack, she raises her fingers in a wave.
If you really want to learn to skate, you should come back when the rink is open to the public.
I will, I say, still looking at the locker. I'm alone in the changing rooms. The muffled sound of classical music permeates from the rink. Leaning my back against the metal door, I pull at the handle, testing the strength of the padlock. Reaching into my hair, I slide a Kirby grip free from against my scalp. Bending it back and forth until it breaks, I bite off the plastic tips, exposing the metal ends. Sliding the sharpest point into the barrel of the padlock, I feel it bumping over the internal mechanism, forcing down the sequence of pins. A kid called Forager taught me how to open locks. We called him Forager because he used to break into the kitchens at Langford Hall and steal packets of biscuits, juice boxes, and the chef's private supply of chocolate. Forager could open almost anything. He began teaching me, but I gave up after mastering padlocks because I kept getting caught and punished. This one is easy. I hear a telltale click and the shackle releases, falling open in my hands. Inside the locker, I find ballet shoes, leggings, socks, and a fleece-lined jacket with a badge saying British Junior Figure Skating Team. I check the jacket pockets and upend the shoes. On the lowest shelf, pushed to the back, I discover a padded yellow envelope with a torn flap. Inside is Jodie's passport and a handful of SIM cards, still in their packaging, as well as a cheap mobile phone. Tipping the envelope upside down, I discover a pen-shaped object with writing on one side and a small circular window with two pink vertical lines. I know what this is. A pregnancy test. A door opens somewhere out of sight and I feel the slight change in the air temperature. I close the locker and lean against it, slipping my hand behind my back and securing the padlock. The envelope is tucked under my right arm, beneath Cyrus's loose-fitting denim shirt.
"What are you doing in here?"
asks a woman. She's one of the coaches I saw on the rink.
"I needed the bathroom." "This is for Academy students only."
"I was busting." The woman eyes me skeptically, but I try to match her stare, opening my palms as if to say, "Nothing to see here."
"I think you should leave."
"Don't get all shitty on me."
"What did you say?"
"I said, don't get shirty. I made a mistake, I'm sorry." I flounce confidently between the benches, turning right through the door, cradling the envelope under my arm. Along the tunnel, up the stairs, through the exit doors. I don't look back until I reach Cyrus, who is waiting in the foyer.
"Where have you been?"
he asks, sounding relieved.
"Lou."
"You shouldn't just wander off."
"Why? Am I a prisoner? Did you want to follow me to the ladies? You could watch me. Some men get a kick out of that." He doesn't answer. Side by side, we cross Bolero Square. I have to lengthen my stride to keep up with him.
"Jodie Sheehan wanted to quit skating,"
I say, making it sound like a revelation.
"Who told you that?"
"Alice. She's one of the other skaters." Cyrus stops and turns.
"How do you know Alice?"
"I talked to her when she came off the rink. Alice said Jodie had a boyfriend. He was older, she said, but didn't know his name." Cyrus is staring at me, unsure how to react. I pull the envelope from inside my shirt. "You didn't tell me that Jodie was pregnant."
"How could you possibly know that?"
"I found this in her locker."
Chapter 37. Yelling at Evie is like shouting at a TV or at a car that won't start. I can hear myself getting more and more worked up while she regards me with utter ambivalence, or worse, complete disdain. "Have you any idea of how many laws you've broken? The position you've put me in? That was someone's private locker. You stole possible evidence. You could be charged. I could lose my job. Bad show, Evie, bad show." She gives me a dull stare. No regrets. No remorse. Whatever warmth or connection may have existed has gone, replaced by an icy wasteland that I might never cross again. I order her into the car. She doesn't react. Pedestrians are watching us, drawn by my raised voice. I'm clutching the yellow envelope as though it's going to explode in my hands. The wind lifts hair from Evie's forehead and makes her eyes water, but she doesn't blink. It's as though she is closing down her mind, going somewhere else. I stop myself and swallow my anger.
Evie isn't ambivalent or unmoved. She is doing what she's always done when under attack. She's escaping to a safe place. This is how she survived years of sexual abuse.
"Please get in the car," I say, softening my voice. Evie looks at the open door. "I shouldn't have shouted at you. I'm sorry."
She doesn't say anything. "Do you want to go back to Langford Hall?"
"Is that what you want?"
she whispers. The question thumps into my chest. I should say something to reassure her, but I'm too angry. What am I to do with this girl? I know practically nothing about her, despite having read her files. She is surly, ungrateful, stubborn, and her presence in my life makes it seem impossibly overcrowded. I want to yell, "Don't be a child, grow up!" But Evie had no childhood. This is it.
We drive through steady traffic and spitting rain to the sound of my wiper blades slapping against the side of the windscreen. When we reach the house, Evie goes upstairs to her room. An hour later, I stand outside her door, unsure of whether to knock. I press my ear against the panels of wood. Nothing. Retreating to the library, I empty the contents of the envelope onto my desk. The pregnancy test, and the SIM cards, and the cheap mobile phone. An old-fashioned Nokia with a flip screen, most likely second-hand. I should give the envelope to the police. How would I explain it? If I tell them that Evie broke into Jodie's locker, they'll send her back to Langford Hall, and I'll likely be investigated and lose my job. Perhaps I could post the envelope anonymously, or leave it on Lenny's doorstep. Evie's fingerprints will be on the contents. So will mine. Shit. The police already know that Jodie was carrying a second phone on the night she died, because she kept receiving messages after her own handset was turned off. Now we have proof of a third cell phone and multiple SIM cards. Why would a 15-year-old girl need different phone numbers? And what was she doing with £6,000? Yesterday, at the Whittakers' house, Brianna hinted that Jodie wasn't as innocent as everybody made her out to be, and said I should talk to her brother. It sounded like teenage bitchiness, but hinted at more. Felix Sheehan could be the key to this. In the meantime, I have to do something about the envelope. Opening my laptop, I put a Skype call in to Lenny. She answers on her mobile. I hear laughter in the background. Am I interrupting?
The Sunday lunch. It's like feeding time at the zoo.
I have a package that belonged to Jodie Sheehan. You can't ask me how I came upon it.
I can, and I will,
says Lenny, not in the mood for games. Someone left it on my doorstep.
Don't fuck with me, Cyrus.
I need this favour.
Seconds tick by. I can hear her breathing.
Where is this mystery package?
You should send a car.
Chapter 38. Angel Face.
I'm sitting in the lee of a bus shelter, head down, hood up, listening to the traffic swish past on the wet road. My anger is so hard against my front teeth that I can taste it in my mouth. Cyrus had no right to shout at me. I was trying to help him, to do something nice. I don't need his lectures, or his charity, or his sad eyes, or his psychoanalysis. Fuck him! A bus pulls up, and the doors fold open. I hesitate for a moment.
Are you getting in?
Asks the driver in a thick accent. I step on board and hand him money.
No cash,
he says irritably.
Card only.
I remember Cyrus gave me some sort of travel pass. I search my pockets and hand it over.
Tap. On reader. Box. Here.
How should I know? I mutter as the bus pulls away. I sway down the aisle and choose a seat where I can't see my reflection in the mirror. Beneath my overcoat, I'm wearing the dress that Caroline Fairfax chose for my court appearance, but I've unpicked the high collar and undone the top buttons, making it look sexier. Mascara and eyeshadow have made my eyes look bigger and my lashes thicker. Chloe Pringle once told me that lipstick was supposed to emphasize a woman's sexuality by echoing the colour of her labia. I thought this was disgusting and stopped wearing lipstick for a month. Reaching into my coat pocket, my fingers close around my roll of banknotes, my stash, my stake. Soon, I won't need Charity, or Cyrus, or anyone else. The old brick warehouse is squeezed between a minicab office and used car yard, close enough to the railway line for the whole building to shake when the freight trains roar past. Opposite is a vacant lot where a handful of cars are parked amid mounds of rubble and patches of weeds. The bouncer on the door is wearing a neck brace that makes him bend from the waist when he looks down at me.
What do you want?
I'm looking for a cash game.
How old are you?
18.
You got proof?
I shrug off my coat, revealing my dress and boots. I've bundled my hair on top of my head, trying to look older.
Nice try,
he says.
Piss off.
I peel off 2 twenties and slide the notes into his trouser pocket, letting my hand brush over his groin. How old do I look now? I whisper. When he flinches, I duck under his arm, through the doorway, and up a set of stairs before he can stop me. The cashier is a large woman with peroxide blonde hair that seems to glow in the dark. She's sitting in a wooden booth behind a glass window. I hand her the roll of banknotes and watch her count out stacks of coloured chips that she takes from a drawer. Cupping my hand over each stack, I pick up the chips and let them drop through my fingertips, counting by touch. You've shorted me. The house takes 5%, says the cashier. You're in the Aces High Room, third door on your right. Toilets are out back, drinks are extra. You want to nap during games, find a couch. They can't be reserved. I take my chips and move along the corridor, not bothering to knock before entering. Nobody looks up. 4 men are sitting at a green baize table in a circle of bright light and a haze of cigarette smoke. Each has a pile of chips in front of him and tumblers of various spirits. The dealer is a young woman, perched on a stool. I clear my throat. The dealer eyes me curiously. Hello, sunshine, you're new. Are you waiting for someone? No, I'm here to play. One of the men laughs.
Go home and watch Sesame Street.
The dealer kicks him under the table. Where are your manners? The fat man rubs his shin and fetches a chair from across the wall, positioning it next to him.
You sit right here, young lady,
he says, pretending to dust the seat.
You're gonna bring me luck. You need more than luck. You need divine intervention,
says a large black man with tight curly hair and a small emerald stud in his left ear. A third man is wearing sunglasses that seem to swallow half his face and a t-shirt that says, I could give up gambling, but I'm no quitter. He continues the conversation.
You're so unlucky. If you fell in a sack full of tits, you'd come up sucking your thumb.
A fourth man interrupts, his voice shaking the room.
Why don't you all shut up and play the fucking game?
His face is drooping on one side, as though collapsing in on itself, while the other side is so animated that one eye sparks dangerously.
What are you staring at?
I look away, wishing I could unsee the image. The dealer leans closer. Don't you worry about Barnum. He's all bark and no bite.
Old Jack's and no aces,
says the fat man, who blows his nose on a tissue and shoves it into the pocket of his shapeless jacket. The dealer is in her late 20s, dressed in black trousers and a white blouse. I'm Caitlin, she says. You want something to drink? No, thank you.
Come on. Have a drink,
says the black man, holding up a bottle of scotch.
I'm Livingston.
Don't force her,
says the fat man, whose paunch is like a pregnancy.
Deal the fucking cards,
says Barnum, drumming his manicured fingers on the baize.
We're playing Texas Hold'em, says Caitlin. No limit. The buy-in is 2,000. The blinds are 10 and 20.
I arrange my chips on the table in order of value, so that I can see at a glance exactly how much money I've won or lost. The first hands are playing quickly as I feel my way into the game. Even when I draw strong hole cards, I fold quickly, letting others fight for the pot. The fat man is easy to read. He talks too much and fidgets, constantly counting and recounting his chips. Shades is also an open book, because he procrastinates before making each bet and always checks on the river. Livingston reveals himself through his superstitions, betting from a different pile of chips depending on the strength of his hand. Barnum is the wild card, because of his drooping face and his impatience, constantly trying to speed up the game. He's the kind of player who waits until he has good hole cards before committing himself to a hand, but reacts carefully, often betting or raising before the flop, but folding quickly if it threatens him in any way. 2 hours later, I'm £500 to the good, having won regularly, but never too much. Each of them has tried to bluff at some point. I let them go, folded, watched. Midnight comes. The game is down to 4 because the fat man has gone home. I've doubled my initial stake. More. That's it for me, I say, getting up from the table.
What's wrong, girlie? Past your bedtime?
Says Barnum.
Let her go,
says Livingston.
She's taken all our money so she can stay for one more hand. What's the harm?
Don't let him bully you, says Caitlin. I know I should quit while I'm ahead, but I'm well ahead. Retaking my seat, I watch the hole cards being dealt. I get a pair, 2 nines. Barnum pushes a stack of chips into the centre without counting them. He's making a play, keeping his eyes fixed on mine, challenging me. But he's got nothing. Zilch. A clumsy bluff. I match his wager and wait for the flop cards, which give me another 9. Barnum isn't looking at me now. Instead, he lifts and drops a stack of chips, counting them between his fingers. He pushes one stack into the centre. Then, another. £3,000. I hear Caitlin's intake of breath. A voice inside my head tells me to fold, to walk away, to pocket my winnings. Don't play this game. Don't trust this man. I look at the pot. I could run a long way with that much money. I could set myself up.
Come on, girlie. Show us what you're made of,
Barnum brays. I don't like him, but I can't let that influence me. His head is down. His hands are covering his cards. I want him to look at me. I need to see his face.
Are you going to grow a pair or fold?
He says, tilting his head. His good eye catches the light. I push my chips into the centre of the table. All of them. The mood in the room has changed. This is no longer a game. It's combat. The river card is dealt. The jack of spades. Barnum throws back his head and laughs. Something is wrong.
All jacks and no aces, eh?
He says, sliding his hands away from his cards and flipping them over. He has 3 jacks. I don't bother turning my cards. I get up from the table and take my coat from my chair.
You played a good game, but you got schooled,
says Barnum. I turn slowly and whisper, you cheated. Air leaves the room like a lung collapsing. Barnum gets to his feet, growling,
what did you say?
I lean across the table and turn the jacks. These are newer cards. You swapped them in. I know I'm right. It's written all over his face, the lie. Shades holds up the cards, comparing them to the rest of the deck. 2 of them look newer.
She's a liar, says Barnum.
Empty your pockets,
mutters Shades.
Fuck off.
Barnum holds the bottom of his shirt, creating a basket, and scoops poker chips from the table. Livingston grabs him by the wrist. Barnum swings a punch with his other hand, but the black man is bigger, quicker, and stronger,
Poker chips spill across the floor, rolling and rattling under the table and chairs. Barnum is pushed face first against the wall with his right arm twisted behind his back. Playing cards fall from his other sleeve, two queens and two kings, along with a seven of clubs and a six of hearts. He's been holding picture cards, waiting for his chance to swap them in. The bouncer's boots are heavy on the stairs, and his shoulders threaten to widen the door. Caitlin pulls me away, shepherding me into another room.
But my money! I'll fix it!
She locks the door, and we listen to the blonde cashier yelling at Barnum, telling him he's barred. Barnum threatens to call the police and have you all arrested.
And I'll tell your wife how much money you owe me,
yells the cashier. Caitlin pulls a packet of cigarettes from the strap of her bra.
Christ, you were cool in there. How did you know he was cheating?
I gesture with a lift of my shoulders.
I've never seen anyone play poker like you. The way you stare people down, you're fearless.
She offers me a cigarette. I accept, wishing I could stop my hands from shaking. The lighter flames, smoke is exhaled in a cloud.
You should play professionally, says Caitlin. You'd be a rock star.
I don't answer. I want to get away from this place.
You could join the poker tour, says Caitlin. There are big tournaments all over the world, televised events. With your looks and your skill, you'd be top table in no time.
I don't want to be on TV.
We're talking millions. All you need is a decent stake. I could help you. We could be partners.
I don't need a partner.
I could get you sponsorships and brand deals.
Why isn't she listening?
I want my money. Okay, okay. I'll talk to the boss.
I follow Caitlin out of the room. The cashier is on her hands and knees, picking up the fallen poker chips.
They're hers,
says Shades, motioning to me.
Can she prove that?
Asks the cashier.
I'm her proof.
And me,
says Caitlin. Back in her booth, the cashier opens a safe, taking out bricks of cash, which she begins counting.
If you like, I could mine this for you. Keep it in the safe. You can pick it up tomorrow or the next time you play.
I'm not coming back, I say. The cashier looks annoyed. She hands me my money, more than 7 grand. I shove it deep into my coat pocket and descend the stairs. The bouncer is gone, along with Shades, Livingston, and Barnum. The streetlights barely touch on the darkness, and the air is damp with mist. Caitlin has followed me outside.
Do you want a lift?
She asks.
My car is just there.
She points to the vacant lot where two cars are parked amid mounds of rubble. I can't see her face.
Good luck finding a cab at this hour,
she adds, lifting the collar of her coat.
Not around here.
How far is the station?
I ask.
Trains won't be running.
I sniff at the silence.
You could come back to mine,
says Caitlin.
I got a sofa. My boyfriend won't mind.
The quiet descends again.
Make up your mind. I'm freezing my tits off out here, says Caitlin.
She sets off. Halfway across the road, she yells,
Hope you don't run into that arsehole, Barnum.
I glance up and down the empty street, wondering if she's right. She's almost at her car. I run to catch up. She opens the passenger door and leans inside to sweep envelopes and fast food wrappers onto the floor. She straightens and holds the door for me.
Mind your head.
I duck.
In that split second, I realise my mistake, as Caitlin takes hold of my hair and drives my forehead into the frame of the door. It bounces off, and she does it again.
My legs fold, and a knee rises up to meet me on the way down, snapping my head sideways. And then, darkness.
Chapter 39. The night feels tilted. I'm cradling my pager in my hands, staring at the screen, willing Evie to send me a message, any message. She can abuse me for all I care, I just want to know she's safe.
When we first met at Langford Hall, Evie told me that people wanted her dead. I thought she was exaggerating or turning every setback into a catastrophe. What threat could she possibly pose, a teenage girl who has spent a third of her life in care? Sasha Hopewell's parents were the same, convinced their daughter had been hounded out of her home and forced to hide by some nefarious, nameless conspiracy. I shouldn't have shouted at Evie for stealing the envelope. I should have remained calm and let her explain. It should have been a discussion, not a confrontation. But I fucked up. Despite my training, I'm unequipped for this. Floundering. I've searched Evie's room. She didn't take a rucksack with her clothes or her makeup. I think she's wearing the dress and boots that Caroline Fairfax bought her for the court hearing. The other thing I noticed was that she decorated her bedroom, painting the walls with vertical green and white stripes. She must have found some old paint in the laundry or garden shed. I wonder how she managed to get the lines so straight. Again, I've misjudged her. All this time, I thought she was skulking around the place and poking through my stuff, but she was doing something useful. Apart from painting, she reorganized the pantry and the laundry, lining up cans and bottles in alphabetical order and according to size, the labels always facing out. I don't know what to do next. What if she's jumped off a bridge or thrown herself under a train? She could be unconscious or have amnesia. I've called the city's hospitals, asking about admissions. The obvious next step is to contact the police, but I know the ramifications of that. Evie will be classed as a runaway and returned to Langford Hall, where Guthrie and the others will make sure she stays. I don't mind being proved wrong. I didn't force Evie to stay with me. I gave her a choice. I bought her clothes, a new bed, vegetarian food and sugary breakfast cereal. I promised her a phone. I've offered her normality, a home, freedom. In the same breath, I chide myself for being so stupid. Evie is damaged, broken, wild. Victims of child abuse don't associate kindness with trust. There is no fairness or balance. I am everything Evie has learned to mistrust. Men, authority figures, experts. Just being here, alone with me in this house, must have worried her, possibly frightened her. The last time she lived in a house with a man, she was sexually abused and kept in a secret room. She became so reliant on her abuser and traumatized by her ordeal that she didn't run when she had the chance. She hid from his killers and the police and the tradesmen who renovated the house. Even as I rationalize this, another thought occurs to me. I look around the room again, at the freshly painted walls and the aging furniture and the bed that still smells of plastic. On the landing, I glance up the stairs and begin climbing to the top floor. This part of the house is closed up, with the rooms used for storage or awaiting a purpose. I enter each of them, turning on the lights. Not all of them work. The remotest of the rooms is in the attic, reachable by a narrow, uncarpeted set of stairs that creak under my weight. The small, recessed window is grey with cobwebs and dust. Boxes of my grandparents' things are stacked beneath beams that follow the sloping roofline to the eaves. Everything seems to be made on a miniature scale, so that I feel huge. There are signs of disturbance. Finger marks on the dusty flaps of cardboard boxes and smudges on the floor where a trunk has been moved and pushed back into place. Subtle alterations. I picture Evie finding this place, going softly through the stillness and shadows. What was she looking for? As I turn to leave, I notice how some of the boxes have been stacked to form a partition with a small gap in between. Crouching and peering into the space, I discover a nest, of sorts. Evie has spread a dust sheet over the floorboards, perhaps as protection against splinters. She has added blankets and throw pillows, two bottles of water, a packet of dry biscuits, a volume of Encyclopedia Britannica, letters G to H, and a collection of marbles and pieces of coloured glass. Is this where she sleeps, I wonder? Do I frighten her that much? The doorbell rings. My heart lifts. I'm all the way at the top of the house, and it takes an age to reach the front door.
I pull it open, expecting to find Evie. But the man on my doorstep is an old family friend. Or perhaps a friend for someone who has no family. Jimmy Verbich pulls me into a bear hug and holds me for a beat longer than is comfortable. I can feel his breath on my ear and the smoothness of his unshaven cheek. He lets me go.
Dr. Haven!
Councillor Verbich?
I hope you don't mind.
Not at all, I say, unsure of why he's here. Behind him, I see two bulked-up minders, whose bodies are shaped like portaloos and make their expensive suits look like sacks. Most politicians travel with PR types or chiefs of staff. Jimmy has muscle.
I saw the light on.
Because you happen to be passing.
I know you're a night owl.
He looks past me along the hallway.
I like what you've done to the place. Shabby chic.
No, just shabby. With a nod of his head, he tells his minders to wait outside and wipes his expensive Italian shoes on my doormat. He's dressed in pleated trousers, an open-neck shirt and blazer, each item matched to the other.
I doubt if Jimmy has anything in his wardrobe that isn't stylish and colour-coordinated, or perfect for the occasion.
Rich beyond counting, he has twice been mayor of Nottingham, and otherwise served on numerous committees, boards and charitable foundations. He is Nottingham's man for all seasons, a churchgoer, philanthropist, politician, yachtsman, pilot and entrepreneur, with a finger in every pie and a toe in every jacuzzi. Jimmy often boasts about his humble roots, growing up in a soot-stained pit village and losing his father to black lung disease. But there is nothing working class left about his lifestyle or his business interests, which include nightclubs, childcare centres, and a 5-star hotel. Yet he possesses the common man's touch, able to chat to football fans on the terraces or hobnob with opera lovers at the Theatre Royal. I've seen him goal a slap shot from just over the blue line in a charity ice hockey game and hit a 200-yard 5-iron to within 3 feet at a golfing pro-am. People say he's handsome, although I've always found him to be slightly androgynous with his smooth, egg-white skin and wet brown eyes. Now in his early 60s, he has escorted a string of beauties over the years, filling the society pages and gossip columns while remaining stubbornly single. When my parents and sisters were killed, it was Jimmy who paid for the funerals and set up a trust fund for my education. He didn't know my family or me. He did it anyway. Perhaps he felt sorry for me, but so did everybody else. It was Jimmy who stepped up. As the caskets were wheeled from the cathedral, he put his arm around my skinny shoulders and said,
"If you ever need anything, Cyrus, you come to me. Understand?"
In the years that followed, he matched his words with actions, showing up at school speech days and my graduation from university, never acknowledging the fact or seeking publicity. Most people say he's a good man, and I have no reason to doubt that. But having followed the fortunes of Nottingham over the years, I have learned that Jimmy swings like a weather vane when it comes to having his convictions. He always follows the prevailing wind. Although no longer the Lord Mayor, Jimmy is still a city councillor and the Sheriff of Nottingham, a ceremonial position rather than a keeper of law and order. He greets tourists, poses for photographs, and promotes the Robin Hood legend.
"How can I help you, Councillor?" I ask.
"Jimmy, please."
We're in the kitchen. I offer him a drink. He refuses and examines the chair before sitting.
"It's been too long,"
he says.
"I was trying to think. I last saw you at Easter."
"The Parkinson's fundraiser."
"That's the one. You're looking well. Working out, I see."
Jimmy is an expert at small talk, and I let him carry on, knowing this isn't a social call. Not at this hour.
"One of my employees came to see me yesterday. He was rather upset by something you'd done."
"Me?"
"I didn't want to believe him. It sounded so out of character."
"Who are we talking about?"
"Dougal Sheehan."
"I didn't know he worked for you."
"He's my part-time driver and a valued employee. He's in shock, obviously. We all are.
Jodie was such a lovely girl. Passionate. Pretty.
You knew her, I say, keeping the surprise out of my voice.
Didn't everyone?
He replies, before realizing how smart-alecky it sounds.
Dougal introduced me, he explains. Occasionally, we'd drop Jodie off at school in the rolls. She thought that was great fun.
Did you see her skate?
Of course. I was one of her sponsors.
You gave her money?
He shrugs. I paid some of her bills. Dougal and Maggie were very appreciative.
He looks at me, askance.
As you'll recall, I did the same for you after your family died. It's what I do, Cyrus. I help where I can.
Jimmy lets the statement linger, as though wanting me to feel guilty for questioning his motives.